that this distribution depends only on the temperature of the black body and not on the material from which it is made to conjure up the simplest model he could. Despite the great success that the atomic theory has so far enjoyed, Planck wrote in 1882, ultimately it will have to be abandoned in favor of the assumption of continuous matter. 18 years later, in the absence of indisputable proof of their existence, he still did not believe in atoms. Planck knew from the theory of electromagnetism that an electric charge oscillating at a certain frequency emits and absorbs radiation only of that frequency. He therefore chose to represent the walls of the black body as an enormous array of oscillators. Although each oscillator emits only a single frequency, collectively they emit the entire range of frequencies found within the black body. A pendulum is an oscillator, and its frequency is the number of swings per second, a single oscillation being one complete to and fro swing that returns the pendulum to its starting point. Another oscillator is a weight hanging from a spring. Its frequency is the number of times per second the weight bounces up and down after being pulled from its stationary position and released. The physics of such oscillations had long been understood and given the name simple harmonic motion by the time Planck used oscillators, as he called them, in his theoretical model. Planck envisaged his collection of oscillators as massless springs of varying stiffness, so as to reproduce the different frequencies, each with an electric charge attached. Heating the walls of the black body provided the energy needed to set the oscillators in motion. Whether an oscillator was active or not would depend only upon the temperature. If it were, then it would emit radiation into and absorb radiation from the cavity. In time, if the temperature is held constant, this dynamic give and take of radiation energy between the oscillators and the radiation in the cavity comes into balance, and a state of thermal equilibrium is achieved. Since the spectral energy distribution of blackbody radiation represents how the total energy is shared among the different frequencies, Planck assumed that it was the number of oscillators at each given frequency that determined the allocation. After setting up his hypothetical model, he had to devise a way to share out the available energy among the oscillators. In the weeks following its announcement, Planck discovered the hard way that he could not derive his formula using physics that he had long accepted as dogma. In desperation, he turned to the ideas of an Austrian physicist, Ludwig Boltzmann, who was the foremost advocate of the atom. On the road to his blackbody formula, Planck became a convert as he accepted that atoms were more than just a convenient fiction, after years of being openly hostile to the atomic theory. The son of a tax collector, Ludwig Boltzmann was short and stout with an impressive late 19th century beard. Born in Vienna on 20 February 1844, he was, for a while, taught the piano by the composer Anton Bruckner. A better physicist than a pianist, Boltzmann obtained his doctorate from the University of Vienna in 1866. He quickly made his reputation with fundamental contributions to the kinetic theory of gases, so-called because its proponents believed that gases were made up of atoms or molecules in a state of continual motion. Later, in 1884, Boltzmann provided the theoretical justification for the discovery by Josef Stefan, his former mentor, that the total energy radiated by a black body is proportional to the temperature raised to the fourth power, T to the fourth power, or T times T times T times T. It meant that doubling the temperature of a black body increased the energy it radiated by a factor of 16. Boltzmann was a renowned teacher and, although a theorist, a very capable experimentalist, despite being severely short-sighted. Whenever a vacancy arose at one of Europe's leading universities, his name was usually on the list of potential candidates. It was only after he turned down the professorship at Berlin University, left vacant by the death of Gustav Kirchhoff, that a downgraded version was offered to Planck. By 1900, the much-traveled Boltzmann was at Leipzig University, and universally acknowledged as one of the great theoreticians. Yet there were many, like Planck, who found his approach to thermodynamics unacceptable. Boltzmann believed that properties of gases, such as pressure, were the macroscopic manifestations of microscopic phenomena regulated by the laws of mechanics and probability. For those who believed in atoms, the classical physics of Newton governed the movement of each gas molecule. But using Newtonian laws of motion to determine that of each of the countless molecules of a gas was, for all practical purposes, impossible. It was the 28-year-old Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell who, in 1860, captured the motion of gas molecules without measuring the velocity of a single one. Using statistics and probability, Maxwell worked out the most likely distribution of velocities as the gas molecules underwent incessant collisions with each other and the walls of a container. The introduction of statistics and probability was bold and innovative. It allowed Maxwell to explain many of the observed properties of gases. 13 years younger, Boltzmann followed in Maxwell's footsteps to help shore up the kinetic theory of gases. In the 1870s, he went one step further and developed a statistical interpretation of the second law of thermodynamics by linking entropy with disorder. According to what became known as Boltzmann's principle, entropy is a measure of the probability of finding a system in a particular state. A well-shuffled pack of playing cards, for example, is a disordered system with high entropy. However, a brand new deck with cards arranged according to suit and from ace to king is a highly ordered system with low entropy. For Boltzmann, the second law of thermodynamics concerns the evolution of a system with a low probability, and therefore low entropy, into a state of higher probability and high entropy. The second law is not an absolute law. It is possible for a system to go from a disordered state to a more ordered one, just as a shuffled pack of cards may, if shuffled again, become ordered. However, the odds against that happening are so astronomical that it would require many times the age of the universe to pass for it to occur. Planck believed that the second law of thermodynamics was absolute. Entropy always increases. In Boltzmann's statistical interpretation, entropy nearly always increases. There was a world of difference between these two views as far as Planck was concerned. For him to turn to Boltzmann was a renunciation of everything that he held dear as a physicist, but he had no choice in his quest to derive his blackbody formula. Until then, I had paid no attention to the relationship between entropy and probability, in which I had little interest since every probability law permits exceptions. And at that time, I assumed that the second law of thermodynamics was valid without exceptions. A state of maximum entropy, maximum disorder, is the most probable state for a system. For a black body, that state is thermal equilibrium, just the situation that Planck faced as he tried to find the most probable distribution of energy among his oscillators. If there are 1,000 oscillators in total, and 10 have a frequency V, it is these oscillators that determine the intensity of radiation emitted at that frequency. While the frequency of any one of Planck's electric oscillators is fixed, the amount of energy it emits and absorbs depends solely upon its amplitude, the size of its oscillation. A pendulum completing 5 swings in 5 seconds has a frequency of 1 oscillation per second. However, if it swings through a wide arc, the pendulum has more energy than if it traces out a smaller one. The frequency remains unchanged because the length of the pendulum fixes it, but the extra energy allows it to travel faster through a wide arc. The pendulum therefore completes the same number of oscillations in the same time as an identical pendulum swinging through a narrower arc. Applying Boltzmann's techniques, Planck discovered that he could derive his formula for the distribution of blackbody radiation only if the oscillators absorbed and emitted packets of energy that were proportional to their frequency of oscillation. It was the most essential point of the whole calculation, said Planck, to consider the energy at each frequency as being composed of a number of equal, indivisible energy elements that he later called quanta. Guided by his formula, Planck had been forced into slicing up energy, E, into HV-sized chunks, where V is the frequency of the oscillator and H is a constant. E equals HV would become one of the most famous equations in the whole of science. If, for example, the frequency was 20 and H was 2, then each quantum of energy would have a magnitude of 20 times 2 equals 40. If the total energy available at this frequency were 3600, then there would be 36 divided by 40 equals 90 quanta to be distributed among the 10 oscillators of that frequency. Planck learned from Boltzmann how to determine the most probable distribution of these quanta among the oscillators. He found that his oscillators could only have energies 0, HV, 2HV, 3HV, 4HV, all the way up to NHV, where N is a whole number. This corresponded to either absorbing or emitting a whole number of energy elements, or quanta, of size HV. It was like a bank cashier able to receive and dispense money only in denominations of 1 pound, 2 pounds, 5 pounds, 10 pounds, 20 pounds, and 50 pounds. Since Planck's oscillators cannot have any other energy, the amplitude of their oscillations is constrained. The strange implications of this are manifest if scaled up to the everyday world of a spring with a weight attached. If the weight oscillates with an amplitude of 1 centimeter, then it has an energy of 1, ignoring the units of measuring energy. If the weight is pulled down to 2 centimeters and allowed to oscillate, its frequency remains the same as before. However, its energy, which is proportional to the square of the amplitude, is now 4. If the restriction on Planck's oscillators applied to the weight, then between 1 centimeter and 2 centimeters, it can oscillate only with amplitudes of 1.42 centimeters and 1.73 centimeters, because they have energies of 2 and 3. It cannot, for example, oscillate with an amplitude of 1.5 centimeters, because the associated energy would be 2.25. A quantum of energy is indivisible. An oscillator cannot receive a fraction of a quantum of energy. It must be all or nothing. This ran counter to the physics of the day. It placed no restrictions on the size of oscillation, and therefore on how much energy an oscillator can emit or absorb in a single transaction. It could have any amount. In his desperation, Planck had discovered something so remarkable and unexpected that he failed to grasp its significance. It is not possible for his oscillators to absorb or emit energy continuously like water from a tap. Instead, they can only gain and lose energy discontinuously in small, indivisible units of E equals HV, where V is the frequency with which the oscillator vibrates that exactly matches the frequency of the radiation it can absorb or emit. The reason why large-scale oscillators are not seen to behave like Planck's atomic-sized ones is because H is equal to 0.00000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000 trillion. According to Planck's formula, there could be no smaller step than h in the increase or decrease of energy. But the infinitesimal size of h makes quantum effects invisible in the world of the everyday when it comes to pendulums, children's swings, and vibrating weights. Planck's oscillators forced him to slice and dice radiation energy so as to feed them the correct bite-sized chunks of HV. He did not believe that the energy of radiation was really chopped up into quanta. It was just the way his oscillators could receive and emit energy. The problem for Planck was that Boltzmann's procedure for slicing energy required that at the end the slices be made ever thinner until mathematically their thickness was zero and they vanished, with the whole being restored. To reunite a sliced-up quantity in such a fashion was a mathematical technique at the very heart of calculus. Unfortunately for Planck, if he did the same, his formula vanished too. He was stuck with quanta, but was unconcerned. He had his formula. The rest could be sorted out later. "Gentlemen," said Planck as he faced the members of the German Physical Society seated in the room at Berlin University's Physics Institute. He could see Rubens, Luhmer, and Pringsheim among them as he began his lecture. "Zur Theorie des Gesetzes der Energieverteilung im Normalspektrum." On the theory of the energy distribution law of the normal spectrum. It was just after 5 p.m. on Friday, 14th of December 1900. "Several weeks ago I had the honor of directing your attention to a new equation that seemed suitable to me for expressing the law of the distribution of radiating energy over all areas of the normal spectrum." Planck now presented the physics behind that new equation as he derived it. At the end of the meeting, his colleagues roundly congratulated him. Just as Planck regarded the introduction of the quantum, a packet of energy, as a purely formal assumption to which he really did not give much thought, so did everyone else that day. What was important to them was that Planck had succeeded in providing a physical justification for the formula he had presented in October. To be sure, his idea of chopping up energy into quanta for the oscillators was rather strange, but it would be ironed out in time. All believed that it was nothing more than the usual theorist's sleight of hand, a neat mathematical trick on the path to getting the right answer. It had no true physical significance. What continued to impress his colleagues was the accuracy of his new radiation law. Nobody really took much notice of the quantum of energy, including Planck himself. Early one morning, Planck left home with his 7-year-old son, Erwin. Father and son were headed to nearby Grunewald Forest. Walking there was a favorite pastime of Planck's, and he enjoyed taking his son along. Erwin later recalled that as the pair walked and talked, his father told him, "Today I have made a discovery as important as that of Newton." When he recounted the tale years later, Erwin could not remember exactly when the walk took place. It was probably some time before the December lecture. Was it possible that Planck understood the full implications of the quantum after all? Or was he just trying to convey to his young son something of the importance of his new radiation law? Neither. He was simply expressing his joy at discovering not one but two new fundamental constants, K, which he called Boltzmann's constant, and H, which he called the quantum of action, but which physicists would call Planck's constant. They were fixed and eternal, two of nature's absolutes. Planck acknowledged his debt to Boltzmann, having named K after the Austrian, a constant that he had discovered in his research leading up to the blackbody formula. Planck also nominated Boltzmann for the Nobel Prize in 1905 and 1906. By then it was too late. Boltzmann had long been plagued by ill health, asthma, migraines, poor eyesight, and angina. Yet none of these were as debilitating as the bouts of severe manic depression he suffered. In September 1906, while on holiday in Duino near Trieste, he hanged himself. He was 62. And though some of his friends had long feared the worst, news of his death came as a terrible shock. Boltzmann had felt increasingly isolated and unappreciated. It was untrue. He was among the most widely honored and admired physicists of the age. But continuing disputes over the existence of atoms had left him vulnerable during periods of despair to believing that his life's work was being undermined. Boltzmann had returned to Vienna University for the third and last time in 1902. Planck was asked to succeed him. Describing Boltzmann's work as one of the most beautiful triumphs of theoretical research, Planck was tempted by the Viennese offer, but declined. H was the axe that chopped up energy into quanta, and Planck had been the first to wield it. But what he quantized was the way his imaginary oscillators could receive and emit energy. Planck did not quantize, chop into HV-sized chunks, energy itself. There is a difference between making a discovery and fully understanding it, especially in a time of transition. There was much that Planck did that was only implicit in his derivation and not even clear to him. He never explicitly quantized individual oscillators, as he should have done, but only groups of them. Part of the problem was that Planck thought he could get rid of the quantum. He only realized the far-reaching consequences of what he had done much later. His deep conservative instincts compelled him to try for the best part of a decade to incorporate the quantum into the existing framework of physics. He knew that some of his colleagues saw this as bordering on a tragedy. "But I feel differently about it," Planck wrote. "I now know for a fact that the elementary quantum of action, H, played a far more significant part in physics than I had originally been inclined to suspect." Years after Planck's death in 1947, at the age of 89, his former student and colleague James Franck recalled watching his hopeless struggle to avoid quantum theory, to see whether he could not at least make the influence of quantum theory as little as it could possibly be. It was clear to Franck that Planck was a revolutionary against his own will, who finally came to the conclusion, "It doesn't help. We have to live with quantum theory. And believe me, it will expand." It was a fitting epitaph for a reluctant revolutionary. Physicists did have to learn to live with the quantum. The first to do so was not one of Planck's distinguished peers, but a young man living in Bern, Switzerland. He alone realized the radical nature of the quantum. He was not a professional physicist, but a junior civil servant whom Planck credited with the discovery that energy itself is quantized. His name was Albert Einstein. Chapter 2. The Patent Slave. Bern, Switzerland, Friday, 17th March, 1905. It was nearly 8 o'clock in the morning as the young man dressed in the unusual plaid suit hurried to work, clutching an envelope. To a passerby, Albert Einstein appeared to have forgotten that he was wearing a pair of worn-out green slippers with embroidered flowers. At the same time, 6 days a week, he left his wife and baby son, Hans Albert, behind in their small two-room apartment in the middle of Bern's picturesque Old Town Quarter, and walked to the rather grand sandstone building 10 minutes away. With its famous clock tower, the Zeitlogeturm, and arcades lining both sides of the cobbled street, Kramgasse was one of the most beautiful streets in the Swiss capital. Lost in thought, Einstein hardly noticed his surroundings as he made his way to the administrative headquarters of the Federal Post and Telephone Service. Once inside, he headed straight for the stairs and the third floor that housed the Federal Office of Intellectual Property, better known as the Swiss Patent Office. Here, he and the dozen other technical experts, men in more sober, dark suits, labored at their desks for 8 hours a day, sorting out the barely viable from the fatally flawed. 3 days earlier, Einstein had celebrated his 26th birthday. He had been a patent slave, as he called it, for nearly 3 years. For him, the job brought to an end the annoying business of starving. The work itself he enjoyed for its variety, the many-sided thinking it encouraged, and the relaxed atmosphere of the office. It was an environment Einstein later referred to as his worldly monastery. Although the post of technical expert, third class, was a humble one, it was well paid and allowed him time enough to pursue his own research. Despite the watchful eye of his boss, the formidable Herr Haller, Einstein spent so much time between examining patents, secretly doing his own calculations, that his desk had become his office for theoretical physics. It was as if the ground had been pulled out from under one, with no firm foundation to be seen anywhere upon which one could have built, was how Einstein recalled feeling after reading Planck's solution of the blackbody problem soon after it was published. What he sent in the envelope to the editor of Annalen der Physik, the world's leading physics journal, on 17 March 1905, was even more radical than Planck's original introduction of the quantum. Einstein knew that his proposal of a quantum theory of light was nothing short of heresy. 2 months later, in the middle of May, Einstein wrote to his friend Konrad Habicht, promising to send 4 papers he hoped to see published before the year's end. The first was the quantum paper. The second was his PhD dissertation, in which he set out a new way to determine the sizes of atoms. The third offered an explanation of Brownian motion, the erratic dance of tiny particles like grains of pollen suspended in liquid. The 4th paper, Einstein admitted, is only a rough draft at this point and is an electrodynamics of moving bodies which employs a modification of the theory of space and time. It is an extraordinary list. In the annals of science, only 1 other scientist and 1 other year bears comparison with Einstein and his achievements in 1905. Isaac Newton in 1666, when the 23-year-old Englishman laid the foundations of calculus and the theory of gravity and outlined his theory of light. Einstein would become synonymous with the theory first sketched out in his 4th paper, relativity. Although it would change humanity's very understanding of the nature of space and time, it was the extension of Planck's quantum concept to light and radiation that he described as very revolutionary, not relativity. Einstein regarded relativity as simply a modification of ideas already developed and established by Newton and others, whereas his concept of light quanta was something totally new, entirely his own, and represented the greatest break with the physics of the past. Even for an amateur physicist, it was sacrilegious. For more than half a century, it had been universally accepted that light was a wave phenomenon. In On a Heuristic Point of View Concerning the Production and Transformation of Light, Einstein put forward the idea that light was not made up of waves, but particle-like quanta. In his resolution of the blackbody problem, Planck had reluctantly introduced the idea that energy was absorbed or emitted as quanta in discrete lumps. However, he, like everyone else, believed that electromagnetic radiation itself was a continuous wave phenomenon, whatever the mechanism of how it exchanged energy when it interacted with matter. Einstein's revolutionary point of view was that light, indeed, all electromagnetic radiation, was not wave-like at all, but chopped up into little bits, light quanta. For the next 20 years, virtually no one but he believed in his quantum of light. From the beginning, Einstein knew it would be an uphill struggle. He signaled as much by including On a Heuristic Point of View in the title of his paper. Heuristic, as defined by the shorter Oxford English Dictionary, means serving to find out. What he was offering physicists was a way to explain the unexplained when it came to light, not a fully worked-out theory derived from first principles. His paper was a signpost towards such a theory, but even that proved too much for those unprepared to travel to a destination in the opposite direction to the long-established wave theory of light. Received by the Annalen der Physik between 18th of March and 30th of June, Einstein's 4 papers would transform physics in the years ahead. Remarkably, he also found the time and energy to write 21 book reviews for the journal during the course of the year. Almost as an afterthought, since he did not tell Habicht about it, he wrote a 5th paper. It contained the one equation that almost everyone would come to know, E equals mc squared. A storm broke loose in my mind, was how he described the surge of creativity that consumed him as he produced his breathtaking succession of papers during that glorious Bern spring and summer of 1905. Max Planck, the advisor on theoretical physics for the Annalender Physik, was among the first to read on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. Planck was immediately won over by what he, and not Einstein, later called the theory of relativity. As for the quantum of light, though he profoundly disagreed with it, Planck allowed Einstein's paper to be published. As he did so, he must have wondered about the identity of this physicist capable of the sublime and the ridiculous. "The people of Ulm are mathematicians," was the unusual medieval motto of the city on the banks of the Danube in the southwestern corner of Germany where Albert Einstein was born. It was an apt birthplace on 14th of March, 1879 for the man who would become the epitome of scientific genius. The back of his head was so large and distorted his mother feared her newborn son was deformed. Later, he took so long to speak that his parents worried he never would. Not long after the birth of his sister and only sibling, Maya, in November 1881, Einstein adopted the rather strange ritual of softly repeating every sentence he wanted to say until satisfied it was word perfect before uttering it aloud. At 7, to the relief of his parents, Hermann and Pauline, he began to speak normally. By then the family had lived in Munich for 6 years, having moved so Hermann could open an electrical business in partnership with his younger brother, Jakob. In October 1885, with the last of the private Jewish schools in Munich closed for more than a decade, the 6-year-old Einstein was sent to the nearest school. Not surprisingly, in the heartland of German Catholicism, religious education formed an integral part of the curriculum. But the teachers, he recalled many years later, were liberal and did not make any denominational distinctions. However liberal and accommodating his teachers may have been, the anti-Semitism that permeated German society was never buried too far beneath the surface, even in the schoolroom. Einstein never forgot the lesson in which his religious studies teacher told the class how the Jews had nailed Christ to the cross. Among the children, Einstein recalled years later, anti-Semitism was alive, especially in elementary school. Not surprisingly, he had few, if any, school friends. "I am truly a lone traveler and have never belonged to my country, my home, my friends, or even my immediate family, with my whole heart," he wrote in 1930. He called himself an Einspänner, a one-horse cart. As a schoolboy, he preferred solitary pursuits and enjoyed nothing more than constructing ever-taller houses of cards. He had the patience and tenacity, even as a 10-year-old, to build them as high as 14 stories. These traits, already such a fundamental part of his makeup, would allow him to pursue his own scientific ideas when others might have given up. "God gave me the stubbornness of a mule," he said later, "and a fairly keen scent." Though others disagreed, Einstein maintained he possessed no special talents, only a passionate curiosity. This quality that others had, however, coupled with his stubbornness, meant that he continued to seek the answer to almost childlike questions long after his peers were taught to stop even asking them. What would it be like to ride on a beam of light? It was trying to answer this question that set him on his decade-long path to the theory of relativity. In 1888, aged 9, Einstein started at the Luitpold Gymnasium, and he later spoke bitterly of his days there. Whereas young Max Planck enjoyed and thrived under a strict militaristic discipline focused on rote learning, Einstein did not. Despite resenting his teachers and their autocratic methods, he excelled academically, even though the curriculum was orientated towards the humanities. He scored top marks in Latin and did well in Greek, even after being told by his teacher that nothing would ever become of him. The stifling emphasis on mechanical learning at school and during music lessons with tutors at home was in stark contrast to the nurturing influence of a penniless Polish medical student. Max Talmud was 21 and Albert 10 when every Thursday he began dining with the Einsteins as they adopted their own version of an old Jewish tradition of inviting a poor religious scholar to lunch on the Sabbath. Talmud quickly recognized the inquisitive young boy as a kindred spirit. Before long, the two would spend hours discussing the books that Talmud had given him to read or had recommended. They began with books on popular science that brought to an end what Einstein called his religious paradise of youth. The years at a Catholic school and instruction at home by a relative on Judaism had left their mark. Einstein, to the surprise of his secular parents, had developed what he described as a deep religiosity. He stopped eating pork, sang religious songs on the way to school, and accepted the biblical story of creation as an established fact. Then, as he devoured one book after another on science, came the realization that much of the Bible could not be true. It unleashed what he called a fanatic free thinking coupled with the impression that youth is intentionally being deceived by the state through lies. It was a crushing impression. It sowed the seeds of a lifelong suspicion of every kind of authority. He came to view the loss of his religious paradise as the first attempt to free himself from the chains of the merely personal, from an existence which is dominated by wishes, hopes, and primitive feelings. As he lost faith in the teachings of one sacred book, he began to experience the wonder of his sacred little geometry book. He was still at primary school when his uncle Jacob introduced him to the rudiments of algebra and began posing problems for him to solve. By the time Talmud gave him a book on Euclid's geometry, Einstein was already well-versed in mathematics not normally expected of a boy of 12. Talmud was surprised at the speed with which Einstein worked through the book, proving the theorems and completing the exercises. Such was his zeal that during the summer vacation he mastered the mathematics to be taught the following year at school. With a father and an uncle in the electrical industry, Einstein not only learnt about science through reading, but was surrounded by the technology that its application could produce. It was his father who unwittingly introduced Einstein to the wonder and mystery of science. One day, as his son lay ill in bed with a fever, Hermann showed him a compass. The movement of the needle appeared so miraculous that the five-year-old trembled and grew cold at the thought that something deeply hidden had to be behind things. The Einstein brothers' electrical business initially prospered. They went from manufacturing electric devices to installing power and lighting networks. The future seemed bright as the Einsteins notched up one success after another, including the contract to provide the first electric lighting for Munich's famous Oktoberfest. But in the end, the brothers were simply outgunned by the likes of Siemens and AEG. There were many small electrical firms that prospered and survived in the shadow of these giants, but Jacob was overambitious and Hermann too indecisive for their company to be one of them. Beaten, but not bowed, the brothers decided that Italy, where electrification was just beginning, was the place to start afresh. So, in June 1894, the Einsteins relocated to Milan. All except 15-year-old Albert, who was left behind in the care of distant relatives to complete the three remaining years to graduation from the school he detested. For the sake of his parents, he pretended that everything was fine in Munich. However, he was increasingly troubled by the thought of compulsory military service. Under German law, if he remained in the country until his 17th birthday, Einstein would have no choice but to report for duty when the time came, or be declared a deserter. Alone and depressed, he had to think of a way out, when suddenly the perfect opportunity arose. Dr. Degenhardt, the teacher of Greek who thought Einstein would never amount to anything, was now also his form tutor. During a heated argument, Degenhardt told Einstein he should leave the school. Requiring no further encouragement, he did just that after obtaining a medical certificate stating that he was suffering from exhaustion and required complete rest to recover. At the same time, Einstein secured a testimonial from his mathematics teacher that he had mastered the subject to a level required to graduate. It had taken him just 6 months to follow in the footsteps of his family and cross the Alps into Italy. His parents tried to reason with him, but Einstein refused to go back to Munich. He had an alternative plan. He would stay in Milan and prepare for the entrance exams the following October of the Federal Polytechnicum in Zurich. Established in 1854 and renamed Eidgenössische Technische Hochschule, ETH, in 1911, the Poly was not as prestigious as Germany's leading universities. However, it did not require graduation from a gymnasium as a precondition for entry. To be accepted, he explained to his parents, he just needed to pass its entrance exams. They soon discovered the second part of their son's plan. He wanted to renounce his German nationality and thereby remove the possibility of ever being called up for military service by the Reich. Too young to do it himself, Einstein needed his father's consent. Hermann Dooley gave it and formally applied to the authorities for his son's release. It was January 1896 before they received official notification that Albert, at the cost of 3 marks, was no longer a German citizen. For the next 5 years, he was legally stateless until he became a Swiss citizen. A renowned pacifist later in life, once he was granted his new nationality, Einstein turned up for his Swiss Army medical on 13th of March 1901, the day before his 22nd birthday. Fortunately, he was found unfit for military service because of sweaty flat feet and varicose veins. As a teenager back in Munich, it was not the thought of serving in the army that bothered him, but the prospect of donning a gray uniform on behalf of the militarism of the German Reich, which he hated. "The happy months of my sojourn in Italy are my most beautiful memories," was how Einstein, even after 50 years, recalled his new carefree existence. He helped his father and uncle with their electrical business and traveled here and there visiting friends and family. In the spring of 1895, the family moved to Pavia, just south of Milan, where the brothers opened a new factory that lasted little more than a year before it, too, closed. Although amid the upheaval he had worked hard to prepare, Einstein failed the Poly entrance exams. Yet his mathematics and physics results were so impressive that the professor of physics invited him to attend his lectures. It was a tantalizing offer, but for once Einstein took some sound advice. He had done so badly in languages, literature, and history that the director of the Poly urged him to go back to school for another year and recommended one in Switzerland.
By the end of October, Einstein was in Aarau,
a town 30 miles west of Zurich. With its liberal ethos, the Aargau Canton School provided a stimulating environment that enabled Einstein to thrive. The experience of boarding with the classics teacher and his family was to leave an indelible mark. Jost Windler and his wife Pauline encouraged free thinking among their 3 daughters and 4 sons, and dinner each evening was always a lively and noisy affair. Before long, the Windlers became surrogate parents, and he even referred to them as Papa Windler and Mama Windler. Whatever the old Einstein said later about being a lone traveler, the young Einstein needed people who cared about him, and he for them. Soon it was September, 1896, and exam time. Einstein passed easily and headed to Zurich and the Federal Polytechnicum. A happy man is too satisfied with the present to dwell too much upon the future, Einstein had written at the start of a short essay called My Future Plans, during his 2-hour French exam. But an inclination for abstract thinking and the lack of practical sense had led him to decide on a future as a teacher of mathematics and physics. So it was that Einstein found himself, in October 1896, the youngest of 11 new students entering the Poly's School for Specialized Teachers in the Mathematical and Science Subjects. He was one of the 5 seeking to qualify to teach maths and physics. The only woman among them was to be his future wife. None of Albert's friends could understand why he was attracted to Mileva Maric. A Hungarian Serb, she was 4 years older, and a bout of childhood tuberculosis had left her with a slight limp.
During the first year, they sat through the 5 compulsory math courses and mechanics, the single physics course offered.
Although he had devoured his little sacred book of geometry in Munich, Einstein was no longer interested in mathematics for its own sake. Hermann Minkowski, his maths professor at the Poly, recalled that Einstein had been a lazy dog. It was not apathy, but a failure to grasp, as Einstein later confessed, that the approach to a more profound knowledge of the basic principles of physics is tied up with the most intricate mathematical methods. It was something he learnt the hard way in the years of research that followed. He regretted not having tried harder to get a sound mathematical education. Fortunately, Marcel Grossmann, one of the other 3 besides Einstein and Mileva enrolled in the course, was a better mathematician and more studious than either of them. It would be to Grossmann that Einstein later turned for help as he struggled with the mathematics needed to formulate the general theory of relativity. The 2 quickly became friends as they talked about anything that might interest young people whose eyes were open. Only a year older, Grossmann must have been an astute judge of character, for he was so impressed by his classmate that he took him home to meet his parents. "This Einstein," he told them, "will one day be a very great man." It was only by using Grossmann's excellent set of notes that he passed the intermediate exams in October 1898. In old age, Einstein could barely bring himself to contemplate what might have happened without Grossmann's help after he began skipping lectures. It had all been so different at the beginning of Heinrich Weber's physics course when Einstein looked forward from one of his lectures to the next. Weber, who was in his mid-50s, could make physics come alive for his students, and Einstein conceded that he lectured on thermodynamics with great mastery. But he became disenchanted because Weber did not teach Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism or any of the latest developments. Soon Einstein's independent streak and contemptuous manner began to alienate his professors. "You're a smart boy," Weber told him, "but you have one great fault. You do not let yourself be told anything." When the final exams took place in July 1900, he came 4th out of 5. Einstein felt coerced by the exams, and they had such a deterring effect upon him that afterwards he found the consideration of any scientific problems distasteful to me for an entire year. Mileva was last and the only one to fail. It was a bitter blow for the couple who were now affectionately calling each other Johansel, Johnny, and Doxerl, Dolly. Another soon followed. A future as a schoolteacher no longer appealed to Einstein. 4 years in Zurich had given rise to a new ambition. He wanted to be a physicist. The chances of getting a full-time job at a university were slim, even for the best students. The first step was an assistant's position with one of the professors at the Poly. None wanted him, and Einstein began searching further afield. "Soon I will have honored all physicists from the North Sea to the southern tip of Italy with my offer," he wrote to Mileva in April 1901 while visiting his parents. One of those honored was Wilhelm Ostwald, a chemist at the Leipzig University. Einstein wrote to him twice. Both letters went unanswered. It must have been distressing for his father to watch his son's growing despair. Hermann, unknown to Albert then or later, took it upon himself to intervene. "Please forgive a father who is so bold as to turn to you, esteemed Herr Professor, in the interest of his son," he wrote to Ostwald. "All those in position to give a judgment in the matter praise his talents. In any case, I can assure you that he is extraordinarily studious and diligent and clings with great love to his science." The heartfelt plea went unanswered. Later, Ostwald would be the first to nominate Einstein for the Nobel Prize. Although anti-Semitism may have played a part, Einstein was convinced that it was Weber's poor references that were behind his failure to secure an assistantship. As he grew increasingly despondent, a letter from Grossmann held out the possibility of a decent, well-paying job. Grossmann Sr. had learnt of Einstein's desperate situation and wanted to help the young man whom his son held in such high regard. He strongly recommended Einstein for the next vacancy that now arose to his friend Friedrich Haller, the director of the Swiss Patent Office in Bern. "When I found your letter yesterday," Einstein wrote to Marcel, "I was deeply moved by your devotion and compassion, which did not let you forget your old luckless friend." After 5 years of being stateless, Einstein had recently acquired Swiss citizenship and was certain it would help when applying for the job. Maybe his luck had changed at last. He was offered and accepted a temporary teaching job at the school in Winterthur, a small town less than 20 miles from Zurich. The 5 or 6 classes Einstein taught each morning left him free to pursue physics in the afternoon. "I cannot tell you how happy I would feel in such a job," he wrote to Papa Winkler shortly before his time in Winterthur ended. "I have completely given up my ambition to get a position at a university, since I see that, even as it is, I have enough strength and desire left for scientific endeavor." Soon that strength was put to the test when Mileva announced she was pregnant. After failing the poly exams a second time, Mileva returned to her parents in Hungary to await the arrival of the baby. Einstein took the news of the pregnancy in his stride. He had already entertained thoughts of becoming an insurance clerk and now vowed to find any job, no matter how humble, so that they could marry. When their daughter was born, Einstein was in Bern. He never saw Lieserl. What happened to her, whether she was given up for adoption or died in infancy, remains a mystery. In December 1901, Friedrich Haller wrote to Einstein asking him to apply for a vacancy at the patent office that was about to be advertised. The long search for a permanent job seemed at an end as Einstein sent off his application before Christmas. "All the time I rejoice in the fine prospects which are in store for us in the near future," he wrote to Mileva. "Have I already told you how rich we will be in Bern?" Convinced that everything would be settled quickly, Einstein quit a year-long tutoring job at a private boarding school in Schaffhausen after only a few months. Bern was home to some 60,000 people when Einstein arrived during the first week of February 1902. The medieval elegance of the old town quarter had changed little in the 500 years since it had been rebuilt following a fire that destroyed half the city. It was here that Einstein found a room on Gerechtigkeitsgasse, not far from the city's famous bear pit. Costing 23 francs a month, it was anything but the large, beautiful room he described to Mileva. Not long after he unpacked his bags, Einstein went down to the local newspaper to place an advert offering his services as a private tutor of mathematics and physics. It appeared on Wednesday, 5th of February, and offered a free trial lesson. Within days, it paid off. One of the students described his new tutor as about 5'10", broad-shouldered, slightly stooped, a pale brown skin, a sensuous mouth, black mustache, nose slightly aquiline, radiant brown eyes, a pleasant voice, speaking French correctly, but with a slight accent. A young Romanian Jew, Maurice Solovan, also came across the advert as he read his newspaper walking down the street. A philosophy student at Bern University, Solovan was also interested in physics. Frustrated that a lack of mathematics was preventing him from gaining a deeper understanding of physics, he immediately made his way to the address given in the newspaper. When Solovan rang the bell, Einstein had found a kindred spirit. The student and tutor talked for 2 hours. They shared many of the same interests, and after spending another half hour chatting in the street, they agreed to meet the following day. When they did, all thoughts of a structured lesson were forgotten amid a shared enthusiasm for exploring ideas. "As a matter of fact, you don't have to be tutored in physics," Einstein told him on the third day. What Solovan liked about Einstein, as the two quickly became friends, was the care with which he outlined a topic or problem as lucidly as possible. Before long, Solovan suggested that they read a particular book and then discuss it. Having done the same with Max Talmud in Munich as a schoolboy, Einstein thought it an excellent idea. Soon Konrad Habicht joined them. A friend from Einstein's aborted stint teaching at the boarding school in Schaffhausen, Habicht had moved to Bern to complete a mathematics thesis at the university. United by their enthusiasm for studying and clarifying the problems of physics and philosophy for their own satisfaction, the three men started calling themselves the Academie Olympia. Even though Einstein came highly recommended by a friend, Haller had to make sure he was capable of doing the job. The ever-growing number of patent applications for all manner of electrical devices had made the hiring of a competent physicist to work alongside his engineers a necessity rather than a favor for a friend. Einstein impressed Haller sufficiently to be provisionally appointed a technical expert third class with a salary of 3,500 Swiss francs. At 8 o'clock in the morning on 23rd June 1902, Einstein reported for his first day as a respectable federal ink pisser. As a physicist, Haller told Einstein, you haven't a clue about blueprints. Until he could read and assess technical drawings, there would be no permanent contract. Haller took it upon himself to teach Einstein what he needed to know, including the art of expressing himself clearly, concisely, and correctly. Although he had never taken kindly to being instructed as a schoolboy or student, he knew that he needed to learn all he could from Haller. A splendid character and a clever mind. One soon gets used to his rough manner, Einstein wrote. I hold him in very high regard. As he proved his worth, Haller likewise came to respect his young protégé as a prized member of staff. In October 1902, aged only 55, his father fell seriously ill. Einstein traveled to Italy to see him one last time. It was then, as he lay dying, that Hermann gave Albert his permission to marry Mileva, a prospect that he and Pauline had long opposed. With only Solovein and Habicht as witnesses, Einstein and Mileva married the following January in a civil ceremony at the Bern Registrar's office. Marriage is, Einstein said later, the unsuccessful attempt to make something lasting out of an incident. But in 1903 he was just happy to have a wife that cooked, cleaned, and simply looked after him. Mileva had hoped for more. The patent office took up 48 hours a week. From Monday to Saturday, Einstein started at 8 o'clock and worked until noon. Then it was lunch, either at home or with a friend at a nearby cafe. He was back in the office from 2 until 6. It left 8 hours for fooling around each day, and then there's also Sunday, he told Habicht. It was September 1904 before Einstein's provisional position was made permanent with a pay rise of 400 francs. By the spring of 1906, Haller was so impressed with Einstein's ability to tackle technically very difficult patent applications that he rated him as one of the valued experts at the office. He was promoted to technical expert second class.
I will be grateful to Haller for as long as I live, Einstein had written to Mileva soon after moving to Bern in the expectation that a job at the patent office would sooner or later be his. And he was.
But it was only much later that he recognized the extent of the influence that Haller and the patent office exerted on him. I might not have died, but I would have been intellectually stunted. Haller demanded that every patent application be evaluated rigorously enough to withstand any legal challenge. When you pick up an application, think that anything the inventor says is wrong, he advised Einstein, or else you will follow the inventor's way of thinking, and that will prejudice you. You have to remain critically vigilant. Accidentally, Einstein had found a job that suited his temperament and honed his abilities. The critical vigilance he exercised in assessing an inventor's hopes and dreams, often on the basis of unreliable drawings and inadequate technical specifications, Einstein brought to bear on the physics that occupied him. The many-sided thinking his job entailed he described as a veritable blessing. He had the gift of seeing a meaning behind inconspicuous, well-known facts which had escaped everyone else, recalled Einstein's friend and fellow theoretical physicist Max Born. It was this uncanny insight into the working of nature which distinguished him from all of us, not his mathematical skill. Einstein knew that his mathematical intuition was not strong enough to differentiate what was really basic from the rest of the more or less dispensable erudition. But when it came to physics, his nose was second to none. Einstein said he learned to scent out that which was able to lead to fundamentals and to turn aside from everything else, from the multitude of things which clutter up the mind and divert it from the essential. His years at the patent office only heightened his sense of smell. As with the patents that inventors submitted, Einstein looked for subtle flaws and inconsistencies in the blueprints of the workings of nature put forward by physicists. When he found such a contradiction in a theory, Einstein probed it ceaselessly until it yielded a new insight resulting in its elimination or an alternative where none had existed before. His heuristic principle that light behaved in certain instances as if it was made up of a stream of particles, light quanta, was Einstein's solution to a contradiction at the very heart of physics. Einstein had long accepted that everything was composed of atoms, and that these discrete, discontinuous bits of matter possessed energy. The energy of a gas, for example, was the sum total of the energies of the individual atoms of which it was made up. The situation was entirely different when it came to light. According to Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, or any wave theory, the energy of a light ray continuously spreads out over an ever-increasing volume like the waves radiating outwards from the point where a stone hits the surface of a pond. Einstein called it a profound